Support for WPR comes from Tomorrow River Community Virtual School, delivering Waldorf-inspired live virtual lessons to grades 4K through 8th, open to all Wisconsin students. More is at trcvs.org.
It's time for another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller, and today we zero in on lawn and turf care with John Steyer. John, UW Extension horticulturist. He's a lawn and turf research expert in the Department of Horticulture, and an associate professor. We're really glad to have him back to talk about lawn and turf care, and we certainly invite you to join in with your questions. So if you'd like to visit with us and ask John something, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. In the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890 and email us at talk@wpr.org. John Steyer, welcome back.
Thank you, Larry. Great to be back.
We did some renovation in our house, and then as part of that, we put a new patio in. So, you know, some of the lawn got...
You're always doing something.
Yeah, always doing something. Anyway, there was quite a big patch of the lawn that really needed to be redone, and we decided to sod and have the guy sod it. And it was about 2 weeks ago, and seems to be taking down pretty good, but I haven't mowed it yet.
Yeah, it should be taking down really well. We've had some beautiful temperatures, highs in the low to mid-70s, lows in the 40s, 50s. That's just ideal for turf. So you could, if it's been 2 weeks, it's probably rooted down well enough that you could easily get a mower on it this weekend.
Okay.
Just so, what you wanted to do.
Yeah. Well, it's getting, the grass is certainly getting long, and it's nice and lush and green. So I think I'll probably put the mower to it. You really don't want to do that right away on a sodded area, I don't think.
You're right, Larry. Usually on a freshly sodded lawn, you want to stay off of it until you can no longer physically lift the sod up, which is usually 1 to 2 weeks.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what, Denise in Tomahawk has a question for you, so let's go there. Hi, Denise.
Hello, Larry. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I have a question. We live up in the North Woods under a bunch of pine trees. We tried to grow a garden, a vegetable garden, and it didn't work because of not lack of sunlight and all of that. So now we want to convert that garden back into grass. Right now it's just a mass of weeds, and I don't know how to go about getting it back to looking like the rest of the yard.
Well, probably the best thing to do is to remove the existing vegetation there. You can do that by hand, depending on what's there. If you had a garden there, I would guess that there's nothing there but maybe some annual weeds. So you can probably just lightly till up what's already there, call it close enough, and then some fine fescue seed is probably going to be your best bet. And you'll find fine fescue seed under various names like Carefree and no-mow mixtures and things like that. Fine fescues are very narrow-leaved grasses. They're not the typical grasses that we see in most home lawns, but they do very well in shade, especially dry soils compared to most other grasses. And they like the acid soil conditions that we'll oftentimes find up north.
Mm-hmm.
That would be great. And how do you spell that? Fine
fescues, F-I-N-E, F-E-S-C-U-E. And when you look on the seed bag, you'll look for things that actually say creeping red fescue, chewings fescue, and hard fescue. Those are the three main species of the fine fescues.
Now, how far north are you, by the way, Denise?
We're about 40 miles north of Wausau.
Okay, so we're probably getting to be almost too late to seed it yet this fall and have it come up, but you could do what I call a dormant seeding, and probably in late October, early November, after all the leaves are gone off the trees and all chance of germination is essentially passed, go ahead and seed it and then cover it up with some mulch. And you'll have about an 80% chance that'll survive through the winter and come up next spring. If it doesn't, then you reseed next spring.
Sure.
And what would you use for mulch? Probably not the leaves.
Although you could, but they tend to blow away. So straw works very well. If you're on a sloping site, you might want to try to find some erosion control mat.
Okay.
Some Futera blanket works very well. It's made out of recycled wood chips, and it's very lightweight.
And yet it won't blow away so much.
It won't blow away. You stake it down, or else once it gets wet, it sticks to the ground.
So would you wet it?
You could wet it because it's a dormant application, Larry. Oh, okay. So.
Well, that was going to be my question. If I seed this and cover it with mulch, how much water do I give it?
Well, if you do a dormant seeding, early November, for example, it's so cold the seed shouldn't be germinating anyways. So it's irrelevant. You don't even have to water it. There'll be enough water coming from the winter rains and snow melts that it'll start to germinate on its own in the spring.
Okay, great.
And what would you do in the spring if you get it? You know, there's been some dry conditions up there. Would you want water to get started in the spring?
Yeah, in the spring, Larry. If it, for some reason it doesn't work out this winter, and she has to reseed in the spring, then certainly she would probably want to water it very lightly, just the surface of the soil, the top quarter to a half inch or so, once to twice a day, just to make sure that soil is moist up on the top until the grass starts to come up. And then she can back off watering to maybe once every 2 days. And as the grass gets to be about 2 to 3 inches tall, then maybe once a week. And after about 5 to 6 weeks, she can probably be watering no more than once a week, maybe once every 2 weeks, depending on the soil conditions and the rainfall that we're getting.
Great. Well, wonderful. Well, thank you so much.
Right.
This really helped.
Thanks a lot for calling, Denise. Appreciate it very much. If you have a question about your lawn and grass, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Weed control, we can talk as well. You know, we're just a little past in northern Wisconsin that time for best seeding, aren't we? What about southern Wisconsin?
Yeah, southern Wisconsin, we're probably also what I would say about a week or two past. So we like to recommend new lawns or new turf be seeded between August 15th and September 15th. There's no magic to that because, as we all are aware of now, the climate changes every year a little bit one way or another. Some, you know, last year, Larry, we had a blizzard the middle part of October.
Oh, we did.
If anybody out there remembers that. And I remember it very vividly because as I was driving home, I watched a guy in a pickup truck drive right into Bad Fish Creek by my house and submerge his truck. October 15th or 16th. So anyways, every year is variable. But after September 15th, every week that we wait to seed, the chance of that seeding succeeding is reduced. And so at some point, we're probably about that point now, I would just recommend we wait. Do a dormant seeding in early November, even late November in the southern part of the state.
Makes sense. Well, Jeff in Elkhorn's got a question for you, so let's go to Jeff. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. Question. Live in southern Wisconsin, the Elkhorn area, have an established lawn that's very thin, was rented in seed slitter for this weekend. Am I wasting my time?
Well, you're probably not wasting your time, but there's less of a guarantee than if you had seeded 2 or 3 weeks before. Now, the slit seeding, I will say, I oftentimes see better success with that than a broadcast seeding at this time of the year. So I'd go ahead and do it. You already got it lined up. Go ahead and do it.
Thank you.
Now, what happens in the spring if you get only partial results? Then how do you follow up on something like that, John?
Well, it depends. In the spring, if he's reseeding with Kentucky bluegrass, that Kentucky bluegrass, as long as it's properly fertilized and watered and mowed, that can probably continue to spread and fill in some of those bare areas if it's not too bad. Assuming, you know, there's 50 to 75% Kentucky bluegrass cover there. The rest of it he can probably get to fill in on its own.
Just by using good cultural practices.
Just by using good cultural practices. Otherwise, he'll slit seed again as early as he can in the spring.
Tom and Madison, hi to you.
Good morning.
Morning.
I've got a question about rust on a lawn.
Sure.
I've been mowing it about 3 inches for this comparatively dry season that we've had. And since we've had the rain, I'm starting to notice quite a bit of rust on the lawn. Now, when I've noticed it, I've reduced my cutting height and have begun bagging the grass. I'm mowing it about 2.5 inches. What should I do?
Well, you can probably stop bagging it. I assume you're bagging it with the idea of removing the inoculum, which generally makes good sense. But with rust diseases, there's so many spores already in the air and already within the existing grass. It's really like trying to empty the ocean one cup at a time. And so you're probably better off spending your energies elsewhere. I probably also would not reduce the mowing height because if you keep it up around 3 inches, that's plenty of leaf tissue, and the grass will eventually grow out of it. The rust disease generally does not kill our turfs. It just looks unsightly, and the cooler temperatures are going to stop the rust, any more rust infections. And yet, at the same time, this is perfect weather for turf growth. So I would think that as long as you've got some fertility on the turf, some nitrogen on the turf, between that and the cooler temperatures and any rainfall that we're getting and have gotten, the turf will grow out of it within a week to 14 days.
Okay. All right. Now, this seems to be a recurring problem for the last 2 or 3 years. Is there anything that can be done earlier in the year to try and prevent it?
Well, if it's a recurring problem, you probably have predominantly perennial ryegrass in the lawn. Your lawn is probably a little bit shiny compared to some other people's lawns, and that's what ryegrass looks like. And really, the only way to stop it, I don't recommend fungicides for this type of thing on home lawns, is to encourage Kentucky bluegrass. And so you can slit seed in Kentucky bluegrass. And the ryegrass is generally not as cold tolerant as the Kentucky bluegrass, especially if it gets under any bit of ice or anything like that. It will start to die out. And so over time, we would see the ryegrass is dying out, and the Kentucky bluegrasses, whatever there are in the lawn, will start to take over.
There's a fairly large portion which has been replaced with Kentucky bluegrass sod.
Okay.
And even that area seems to have the rust in it.
Well, we'll see Kentucky bluegrass get rust usually only when it's about 1 to 2 years old. And after that, we generally don't see much rust on Kentucky bluegrass. So you might want to send a sample into the Turf Diagnostic Lab and make sure that it is rust that's affecting that Kentucky bluegrass. The rust that infects the Kentucky bluegrass generally does not infect the perennial ryegrass and vice versa.
Okay. Hmm. Okay, I'll raise my lawnmower up and hope that it'll disappear on me here.
All right.
Yep, and keep the fertility up.
Mm-hmm.
Do that before times a year.
Good. Okay.
All right, good enough. Thank you very much for calling. And we just sort of passed one of those fertility times. Usually Labor Day was one time each year.
Yeah. We usually like to use a holiday schedule, Larry, around Memorial Day, July 4th if it's cool, although this year we probably could have bagged that because it was hot and dry. And then around Labor Day and then around Halloween or so.
Yeah. Okay. Good luck, Tom. Thanks a lot. John in Fremont, it is your turn. Hi, John.
Hi. I have last night I had an attack by skunks in my yard,
oh.
And they really tore it up. And my dad looked it up online, and he said that they were, what it said online was that they were after Japanese beetle grubs and that they'll keep coming back night after night. Is that sound true?
Yeah, your dad is probably very right on this one. Skunks will go after essentially anything that tastes good to them or smells good to them in the soil. And unfortunately, all too often, they really go after things when we have infestations of lots of a particular insect. And it's not uncommon for that particular insect to be Japanese beetle grub or even May or June beetle grub. But Japanese beetle grub is a beetle species that's been moving into the state the last several years in force. They're C-shaped grubs. They're white with a brown head. They have six little legs in the front, and they chew on the grass roots. And at this time of year, they're starting to burrow down deeper, and they'll hopefully, for them, for their own sake, burrow down below the frost line before winter hits. And then in the next spring, they'll come up and just feed a little bit, and then they'll emerge as beetles in June. And start to lay eggs and start the whole cycle over again. So if you've got an existing June beetle problem now, there are some Japanese beetle insecticides that can be applied at this time of the year, but if it's not done real soon, they'll be burrowing too deep
for it to be very effective. The insecticides really do need to be watered in, either with irrigation or with rainfall, and the labels talk about that, usually about a half inch of water. So you'll have to set out some cans and estimate how much your sprinkler system is putting out, how long it takes to put a half inch of water out.
I know once in a while Phil will say, you know, it's pretty hard to control. Even if you do the ones in your lawn, they blow right back in.
Unfortunately, it's a difficult situation. You know, these insect pests, they come and go, Larry. And so you might have them there this year, and even if you don't do anything, they might not be there next year. It's kind of a crapshoot in that regard.
Hmm.
But if you wanted to try to stem it now would be about the last date to really probably try to do something before they get too deep down in the soil.
Where would I get that stuff at? Fleet Farm or?
Many stores sell it that carry lawn and garden products. Although the interesting thing is a lot of the stores feel that this is a seasonal item,
right,
and they sell it in the spring, which is not the best time to put it down anyways. The best time to put it down is July or August.
Maybe I better go to a nursery.
So sometimes nurseries or garden stores that focus solely on lawn and gardens will still have it.
All right. Well, thank you for the information.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And we'll take some more calls, but let me remind you, our guest today is John Steyer, UW Extension horticulturist. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, with his Italian intact, just back from a couple of weeks in Italy, our producer, and you are listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking lawn and turf care today with John Steyer, UW Extension horticulturist. Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you listening in. Give us a call. I think we have one open line at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. And Nick in Green Bay is next. So let's go to Nick. Hi, Nick.
Hi. I've got a small problem. I love my birds, but I put a bird feeder up above the sink or above the kitchen window, and that was great. I love my birds. The only problem is now I got corn growing in the backyard.
Yeah.
And I don't want to use pesticides because my dogs put it on there. What? Any suggestions? I mean, I moved it to the front once, and I got corn popping up by the flowers, so I feel like a farmer.
Yeah, depending on what kind of bird seed you buy, that seed oftentimes can germinate. We've got a bird feeder in our perennial garden, and there's all sorts of what I call weeds underneath the bird feeder. But my wife has decided she wants a bird feeder there, and she'll live with the weeds that prop up underneath of it. So
corn
most
really that strong? Like, do they germinate that easy?
Some of these do. It really depends on the seed. You know, there's so many different types of seed that people will use for bird feed. The good thing about the corn is all you have to do is mow it, and since the growing point is at the top, it dies out pretty easily.
Yeah.
Also, the winter will take care of it. But it's going to be a regular thing as long as the bird feeder's there, unless you have some type of catch pan or something underneath of it to catch the seed that falls.
One of the things that we use, we have for thistle seed, for example, for the smaller birds, you can buy the seed where it is guaranteed not to germinate. And
Okay.
So we buy that seed, and that's not really all that expensive. And then for our other bird feeder, we actually use a seed that is, it's all seed and no hulls.
Okay.
And we don't get any, it's more expensive, but then you don't get any weeds, what you might call weeds, underneath your feeding.
Yeah, because when the birds are going after that seed, you know, they take out the hulls, but sometimes they're messy and they'll drop some seed and things like that, too. It's just the way it is.
Yeah.
I thought I was going nuts. I had corn in the backyard, but as it got bigger, I'm like, it's corn. Holy crap.
So. Yeah.
Well, you could have harvested some, you know, Rick.
Turn it into ethanol, you know, it's $5-6 a bushel these days.
Okay. Tom and Madison, hi to you.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
I have a question about my lawn. It's full of weeds right now, and I was wondering what steps I should take at this point.
Do you know what the grass species is in your lawn, and do you know what type of weeds they are?
I don't know. I've got various weeds.
Broadleaf weeds, grassy weeds, both?
I think they're, you know, probably broadleaf, and, you know, I have a real hard time with my lawn. It's kind of a clay, sandy soil.
Mm-hmm.
And one part of it is, you know, most of it's always in sun.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, but it just seems to just really dry out all the time on me.
Okay. What are your mowing practices like? What, how often and what height are you mowing at?
Well, I am trying to mow at, 3 inches.
Okay.
Like they recommend.
Okay. Recycling the clippings back in?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. Fertilizing?
No, I haven't fertilized this spring. I didn't fertilize. I seeded, you know.
Okay.
And it worked for a while, and then it just seemed like everything just died out. And I was watering pretty religiously, so.
Yeah. Well, you know, the grasses, we mow them, and we put traffic and stuff on them. And when we do that, they need more nourishment. It's kind of like a long-distance runner, probably needs a little bit more water than somebody who sits in a chair all day long. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so when we're mowing the grass and so forth, we need to feed them.
Oh, okay.
And so that fertility is going to be important. You know, we can control the weeds with herbicides or plucking them out or anything like that, but they're going to come right back unless we're actively taking care of the turf.
All right.
We have an extension bulletin on lawn maintenance, mm-hmm, that you can pull off the web, and it talks about the mowing and the fertility and the irrigation and so forth and overseeding these problem areas. That might be a good place to start.
Okay.
That's under the University of Wisconsin Extension website, www.uwex.edu.
Okay.
And then go to publications and then lawn garden. You can pull that up.
Okay.
All right. Great.
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Dick in Waukesha, your turn now. Hi, Dick.
Yeah, Tom, who just was on. Keep listening. There's a fellow was on a month or two ago, has a similar, now he didn't consider it a problem, and neither do I, but, and I know of a lawn of this type down in Indianapolis. What do you think of a lawn that's all Creeping Charlie, or almost all?
I think if the person likes the Creeping Charlie, it's just wonderful.
I'm on my way. And Tom, there's a possibility you can go fishing instead of fooling around with all that lawn.
A lot of people want to get rid of Creeping Charlie, though. And it is hard, hard, hard to get rid of Creeping Charlie.
It is. I've got a spot in my yard, Larry, where I had a large tree fall down about 2 years ago, and I haven't done anything with it because it's kind of in a woodsy area. But the Creeping Charlie got started in there, and within the last 2 months, it started to creep out into the lawn.
Yeah.
Gets started in the shade and then creeps out.
Yeah, and it's tough to get rid of. Although we're getting close to a time. If you were interested in applying a chemical treatment, this would be close to the time when you do it, isn't it?
Yeah, we usually like to recommend that chemical treatments for weeds be applied in the mid to late fall for these hard to control perennial weeds like the Creeping Charlie and like the Wild Violet.
And even when you control them, they come back.
They have the possibility of coming back. That's right.
Peter in Madison, your turn. Hi, Pete.
Hello. Yeah, I had a question about the history of lawns. Where did lawns all begin?
Oh, that's interesting. Great question. I love that. I'm actually putting together a poster for the Crop Science Society on the history of turf. As best as we can tell, the turf grasses that we have developed really in conjunction with civilization as we know it. So if you can imagine back about 10,000 years ago, about 8,000 BC, as people started to settle into villages and so forth, they kept their livestock with them right around their houses, sometimes even on the bottom floor of the house. You can still find places like this in Germany and so forth where the bottom floor of the house is kept for livestock at night, because out in the woods there was nasty things that would eat the livestock. And so what we speculate has happened is over the centuries, the trampling and eating by the animals of the vegetation surrounding these villages really killed off a lot of the vegetation except various types of plants, both grasses, and there are some broadleafs that form what we now call a turf. And so the history of the lawns as we know it, we can find references going back even to around 100 BC, 200 AD, and so forth, for example, the kings of Persia having what they called their garden carpets, and these were clipped turfs that they would have at their palaces that they would use for recreation and lounging around and so forth. Later on in the 1500s, 1600s, the games really began to take off. In Hindustan, ancient Hindustan, they played chakbar, which was an ancient form of polo. In the 1300s and 1400s, both France and England, of course, were at war, and they both countries banned the game of bowls, which is a forerunner to lawn bowling, because it was interfering with archery practice. And these two countries were at war with each other during the Hundred Years' War there. Then later on in the 1500s and 1600s, the game of golf originated in Holland, and that was advanced into the game of golf, as we know, in Scotland. And at the same time, the villages were getting bigger, and they started having public meetings and so forth on what became known as the village green, and so they needed some type of turf there. Now, lawns as we know them really got started in the 1800s with the affluent people wanting some turf or something, some ground cover around their homes to keep the dirt out from coming into their houses. And if you go down to the southern part of the country now, you can still find people that grew up without any turf around their houses, and they said, yeah, the dirt just tracked in all the time. And so the turf is used around our houses now as a ground cover to keep that dirt from coming in and for the kids to play on and this, that, and another thing. So some very interesting history there. There are a couple of books that are available, and some of them cover some of this. Dr. Jim Beard, Professor Emeritus from Texas A&M, is actually in the process of writing a book. He's contacted me several times because it turns out the UW-Madison graduated some of the first PhDs to ever work in turf back in the 1920s and 1930s. People like John Dahl and John Monteith.
Very interesting.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Peter, for calling. Appreciate it. Oh, that's so nice. We had never had that question before. I was glad to get it.
Interesting question.
Thanks, Peter. Suzanne in St. Paul, Minnesota. Your turn now. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I have been having trouble with mushrooms in my yard and in my landscaped areas. What can I do to get rid of mushrooms?
Yep. Well, the only thing you can do is really just pluck them or whack them off at the surface of the soil. The mushrooms are coming from a fungus that's growing underground on some type of organic matter. Dead trees, maybe just organic matter that's spread through the soil. If you take a soil sample in virtually from any place and get it analyzed, it's going to have between 1 and 3 to 5% organic matter in it. As vegetation dies, it decomposes, that creates the organic matter in the soil. And the fungus feeds off of this. And at certain times of the year, depending on the fungus species, and there's thousands of fungus species that live in the soil, some of them will send up mushrooms. The brown ones we call LBMs, for little brown mushrooms. But there's all different types.
Do you have a relatively new lawn, or is it an old established
one? Well, I have an established lawn, but it seemed like it got worse after I had a landscape project done last spring, and they brought some dirt in to put a berm and then also wood chips. And so the mushrooms are both in the lawn and the wood chips.
Yep. Yeah,
yeah. The wood chips are definitely a food source for the mushrooms. Now, the soil I brought in was probably high on organic matter, so that could be helping the mushrooms grow a little bit. But they'd probably be there at some point anyways.
So just whack them off.
Just whack them off, mow them. I would not eat them. They're probably not going to be poisonous, but there are a few species out there that can make people sick.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Suzanne. Aaron in Manitowoc. Your turn now. Hi, Aaron.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
Hey, I was wondering, I live in Manitowoc, obviously, and it's we have really, really sandy soil out there. And I'm just trying to figure out, I just moved out there, and what can I use to get a lawn?
Do you have a lot of shade, too, or is it?
A little bit of shade, but not a lot of shade. Mostly it's all sunny area, but a lot of weeds growing.
Have you established a lawn yet?
No, that's what I'm trying to figure out how to do.
Good. Well, a little soil goes a long way in sand. And so you can have the benefits of the drainage provided by the sand and the nutrient and water holding capacity benefits of a soil by if you want to go through the trouble of adding about 10% soil by volume in the upper 6 inches. So that means you need to have about 1.25 inches or so of soil brought in, enough soil brought in to provide a depth of about 1.25 inches across the entire lawn, and then you have to till that in. Okay. Don't leave it on the surface.
All right. I also had another question. I was growing a garden this summer, and being that it's soil, it drains water very quick.
Mm-hmm.
How would I water that? How often would I water it in that? Because it seemed like I would water it in the morning. I heard that it was good to water it around between 4 and 5 a.m., and I would usually water it around that time before I went to work, and by the time I got home, it seemed like the ground was really dry, and I also heard that I shouldn't water it twice a day.
Well, overwatering or watering plants right before it gets dark allows the moisture to remain on the leaf surfaces for a long period of time, 9 to 10 hours, and that's how long fungi need to infect the plant. That's why it's recommended to water in the morning. Plus, you lose less by watering to evaporation by watering at 4 or 5 a.m. than you would at 12 or 1 p.m. or something. Did the plants seem to survive okay in the garden, though, with that water?
They survived all right. I would have to say they were probably better than most other people's plants. But I was just wondering if there was if I should maybe have a system set up to where I could water it at, like, noon when I'm gone, or...
Well, you could. The other thing to do would, again, be to mix some soil into that or some very well-decomposed compost.
Okay.
Into that sand.
All right. Great. All right.
Give it a shot.
Thanks. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Aaron, for calling. Yeah, we have some open lines. Again, you can get on with your question as we talk lawn and turf with John Steyer, UW Extension horticulturist Larry Mueller here. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Rick and Toma, hi to you.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got two issues, but my primary issue is ants. I've got two different types of pine trees. The ants are like, I guess, the type of carpenter ants. They're about 3/4 of an inch long, black, fairly large.
Okay.
And they're living in the trees then.
Right. But, like, 3 or 4 times a year, they seem to come out of the trees,
yep,
and they infest the ground, and I put the, you know, general-purpose ant poison down, and it seems to work for maybe a few days or a week or so, but the entire colony just seems to move and resurface,
yep,
and kill another part of my lawn.
Yep. And so that's the way ants work.
Okay.
And, you know, so you could think, well, maybe I ought to just keep treating the entire lawn all the time, but at some point you have to consider, is it really worth it? Or can you just live with the ants moving around here or there?
And they're killing, you know, a good 6x8x10 patch of lawn.
Yeah, they'll do that. You know, the other option, if it's a carpenter ants, of course, is to remove those trees, because those trees are rotting out anyways if they're living in there, and they are posing a potential danger if they fall them.
They are.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, that's pretty much what I'm afraid of. Unfortunately, one of the pine trees is right over the house. Very expensive to remove it from top down.
Very expensive, but consider this. What happens when it's 11 o'clock at night on a Sunday night, you've got a big deal going on Monday morning at work, there's a thunderstorm,
right,
and that tree falls on your house.
Right.
Yeah. Then it's really expensive.
then it's really expensive and potentially dangerous.
Yeah. And then my second point is, maybe it's because of the pine trees, the back half of my lawn, which gets primary sun, is awesome grass. And the rest of it, I can't ever seem to do anything with it. It's primarily in shade, and of course, I've got two big pine trees.
Yeah.
Any recommendations as far as what will grow in that type of condition?
Well, fine fescues are probably your best bet out in that situation. But I think if you remove those pine trees, you'll have other options, too.
That's unfortunately the way that I'm leaning.
Yeah, I know it's expensive, but...
Sometimes you have to do
it.
Yeah.
Is that I've had shrews, and I've never had them before, but they seem to be taking over this year.
Shrews?
Oh, shrews.
Short-tailed shrews. I've looked them up online, and that's definitely what they are. The only reason I found out is because we got a cat recently, and it's been moved outside, been neutered, and he seems to bring home about one or two a day for about the last 2 weeks.
Yep.
And they are truly, I went around the foundation and found probably 30 or 40 holes.
Wow.
Ideas on how to get rid of a pest like that?
You know, I've not seen shrews infesting a lawn. I've seen chipmunks, lots of moles and things like that. But again, I think most of the time these animal problems are kind of hit and miss.
Right.
You know, yeah. you could probably set out traps for shrews, but I have never heard of a shrew infestation around a house before,
I
wouldn't be able to tell you how to do that.
I did at first think they were moles, but then I looked up and it's like they're a short-tailed shrew. Yeah. Interesting.
You might be better off talking to an animal control person.
Sure.
Yeah. Or is Larry? Do you have a wildlife ecologist registered for the show sometime soon?
Scott Craven can definitely talk about that. He's on the first Wednesday of the month, which is coming up pretty quickly next week.
Yeah,
next week.
Next week Wednesday.
Great. Thanks so much for your time.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. There are ways that you can control them, but it takes a little bit of work. And they can be a problem in, you know, around shrubs and stuff because they can also eat the shrubs.
Eat the bark around it and girdle the cambial tissue.
Yeah. So it's probably a good idea to get rid of them. We have more callers. Let's go to Margaret in Appleton. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I'm calling. I have a problem. Well, I'm not sure if it's a problem. I have a yard that's about 10 years old. When the yard was put in, it was a mixture of fescue and perennial rye and bluegrass. It looks really nice as you look at it, sort of, you know, looking across the yard. I've noticed in the last couple of years that we have an awful lot of clover that seems to be spreading, mm-hmm. so that we have areas where it looks like it's almost all clover and not a whole lot of grass left in some of those areas. And I don't see that in my neighbor's yards. So I'm wondering, my husband was questioning whether... almost everyone around us has lawn service, and we don't do that. So I control broadleaf weeds, just spot treatment.
Good for you.
And the question is, do we have it and the others don't because they're using weed and feed, and would that control clover? Or my husband said that years ago they used to put clover in grass seed mixes and that it was supposed to be good for the yard. And I'm trying to figure out now since some areas, it just seems to be sort of taking over. I have these huge patches.
Yep.
Is that a problem or not?
Well, it's only a problem if you don't want the clover there. Your husband's right. They used to put clover in lawn seed mixes. Clover has a relationship with a bacterium, and it can actually make its own food, its own nitrogen source from the gaseous form of nitrogen, which is about 80% of the air that we breathe. So it doesn't really need fertilizer. The grass needs fertilizer, and so I would guess that your neighbors are probably getting sufficient fertilizer to keep the grass happy, and it's keeping the clover from coming in. And so if you're not fertilizing sufficiently for the grass health, the clover will be coming in. There's also a possible issue if some of the grass seed was not a very good quality grass and the grasses have died out over time for one reason or another, then there's an open space. And as you know, the saying, nature abhors a vacuum, and so the clover is grown there. But it's probably mostly a fertility issue.
We usually do the four times a year, although we did skip July this year because of the
I would have skipped July too.
And we do mulch the grass back into
good.
The yard. So,
okay.
You know, we're trying to do those things and mow it 3.5 inches and all that stuff.
Yeah.
I guess the question is, when you were talking before about having just perennial rye, I look at this grass and to me it all sort of looks the same, even though it may have started out with three different kinds of seed. Is there a way to tell what's left there? how do you tell the difference between perennial rye and bluegrass and that sort of thing?
Mm-hmm.
Should I even care if it's green and I mow it? Maybe I shouldn't even care at this point.
Well, I don't like to see a whole lot of perennial ryegrass in a lawn because it's, in my mind, for Wisconsin, kind of a weak grass because it can winter kill so easily compared to either the fine fescues or the Kentucky bluegrass. What happens is people oftentimes will put them in a seed mix with the idea that you get some very quick germination out of the ryegrass because the fescues and the bluegrass is germinating much slower.
But if there's too much ryegrass in that seed mix, it crowds out the other grasses, and they never really have a chance to get established. Okay. So, you know, trying to describe to you how to tell them apart over the air is very difficult. The ryegrass is shinier than the Kentucky bluegrass. The Kentucky bluegrass has a transparent rib, if you will, if you hold it up to the light. The ryegrass doesn't. The fine fescue, the leaves are needle thin. Though that's probably the best description I can give you over the year. Your county extension office, if you took a sample to them, they might be able to tell you what that is.
Okay. I also had one other question. We have had what looks like, we call powdery mildew. We've had this white in the backyard in particular, which has become much more shady over the last 10 years since this was put in. And my husband has put down what he calls Immunox, I think, which is supposed to be a systemic kind of control for this.
Okay.
And it does seem to control it for a while, but then it comes back again. And I'm to the point that when you mow, you actually see kind of a white cloud of this
That's
stuff spreading around.
Okay.
Is that something, again, that we can do something about other than just keep putting down this chemical?
Yes and no. So the fact that you have powdery mildew in the shade tells me that you have some Kentucky bluegrass in there.
Okay.
We don't see powdery mildew on perennial ryegrass or fine fescue
of. Well, we definitely have
so that. So that tells me you've got Kentucky bluegrass back there. There are some Kentucky bluegrass varieties that don't get powdery mildew, like the ones that you have. But your chances of getting those varieties are probably very, very few and far between, because there's only a handful of varieties, and most the retail stores are not going to carry them variety by variety. So you'd have to go on the web to a place like, I think it's called SuperSeedSolution.com or something like that, and order a specific variety. But that gets to be terribly laborious, and it's probably not going to work out for you. So the other option, what your husband is doing is applying what we in the industry call a fungicide, what the food industry calls a mold inhibitor, and what the healthcare industry calls something like athlete's foot cream or something like that. It's all the same stuff. But interestingly, Larry, my son was looking at labels for a project for school the other day, and they were listing these things as mold inhibitors. We call them fungicides when we apply them on turf. So you can do that. I generally don't advocate doing it because I just think it's a needless use of a fungicide, although in your case, maybe it really is necessary. The other option is to plant fine fescues in that area because they will not get it, and they're fairly shade tolerant.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. John Steyer, UW Extension Horticulturist. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller, here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking lawn and turf care with John Steyer, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for listening in. We'll go right back to the phones, and David in Dresser is next. David, hello.
Greetings.
Greetings.
I guess I'm in one of those categories that's sort of the opposite with my lawn here. It's probably close to 100 years old, and a tough guess as to what it was established from. But I do everything I can to kill it. I am so mean to it. I cut it very, very short. I don't water it. I don't fertilize it. And it stays very nice. I watch my neighbors work so hard to keep theirs up, but in the hot part of the summer, I've done nothing, and it still looks beautiful. I feel sorry for the other folks, I guess.
Well, what do you think, John?
I think that's a wonderful story. It's interesting. Back around the early 1900s, as the suburbia really was developing, people were planting oftentimes what was known as South German bent grass, which was a mixture of various types of bent grasses, velvet bent grass, colonial bent grass, some creeping bent grass, and so forth. And they actually do fairly well at lawn height. The creeping bent grass, same ones that we use on the golf course these days. But we mow them very short on the golf course. And for home lawns, they'll do okay. They'll get puffy, and sometimes they'll be prone to scalping and some fungus disease and so forth. But, yeah, you know, they can make a okay lawn sometimes.
Well, you practically answered my other question. My question was, in this very cold part of the country, what type of seed do they use on the putting greens at golf courses?
Yeah, it's creeping bent grass. The bent grasses have very, very, very good cold tolerance. They grow very easily up into the subarctic.
Well, that's wonderful. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And they'll take a real short mow.
They'll take a real short mow. The best mowing height for creeping bent grass is between 0.2 inches. And so on the golf courses, Larry, when they are having trouble with all these diseases like dollar spot and so forth, it's because they're mowing them too darn short.
All right. Thanks again, David. Appreciate it. And Charles in Mount Horeb, your turn now. Hi, Charles.
Good morning. I had a question regarding the control of voles or shrews in turf grass, and I was listening to a previous call, and it was suggested that the question be directed to Scott Craven, which I understand he's scheduled for next Wednesday.
Yes, he is.
Okay, I'll hold my question until then. Thank you.
Good luck.
Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. We've had a mole problem in our lawn in past years, and I've just not been able to get that mole out of there. And when I think I might have done it because it was only in one area of the lawn, and when we put a patio in, they had to dig out.
Oh, you think you disturbed it or something?
I think I might. What I was hoping for is they somehow crushed it or did it in.
Yeah. Well, you know, moles come and go. I remember, you know, sometimes I've had them in my lawn, and they'd be a problem for 1 year, and then 2 or 3 years later, I wouldn't see them for 2 or 3 more years. You know, I don't know why.
Never know why. And frankly, the mole problem I've had, it never occurs until August.
Huh.
And yep. It goes fine until mid-August or so, and then I start getting mole problems.
Yep.
It's weird. Doug in Blue Mounts, hi to you.
Good morning, gentlemen. I Googled Creeping Charlie on the Internet, and I got a University of Minnesota solution that a weak borax solution that's like 20 mule team borax.
Yep.
Sprayed on Creeping Charlie might control it, because I guess the Creeping Charlie is more sensitive than the grasses to boraxes. Would you agree with that, or I've never tried it yet?
Well, this information is coming out of a study that was conducted concurrently at Iowa State University and the University of Wisconsin-Madison back around 1994, 1995, so the information is about that old. And the results show that, yes, it had partial control of Creeping Charlie. It did injure the grass, but not quite as much as a Creeping Charlie. The thing to remember with this, though, is that it's the borax in the boron, which is an element in the borax. Boron does not break down. It is already an element. It cannot break down any further.
Great.
It can quickly build up to toxic levels in the soil. So if you use it once or twice, no big deal. But if it's being used on a repeated basis, at some point, it will become toxic to all plant life there.
Oh, I see.
And the other thing to keep in mind is it's a superficial remedy. It burns the leaves off the Creeping Charlie. It does nothing to remove the stolons, which are producing the leaves. And so a month or two after, it's got new leaves on it, and then you've got to go out and treat it again.
Oh, I see.
It's also not a registered product for this use.
Oh, it's illegal.
And so I can't, I am not allowed by law to recommend use of a non-registered product as a pesticide.
Or an herbicide.
Well, if it doesn't work permanently, I guess it
would
be a good idea.
We can dicker if it works or not. You know, I can show you the data that show, it removed 50% of the observable Creeping Charlie for a month.
Yeah.
Right.
So one can argue, did it work? Well, yes. Did it work? Well, no.
Mm-hmm.
I see.
If you're going to control it, As you were saying earlier, it needs to be controlled kind of late in the season.
Yeah, late in the season. You know, probably October. If somebody wants to pin me down on a date, probably sometime in October. Usually we like to see some frost having occurred already, because at that point, then the weed starts to take their sugars down to the growing point, and the herbicide that gets in the leaves will be taken down to it too. And hopefully kill it. And even if it doesn't kill it, then the plant goes into winter in a weakened state. And imagine a bear hibernating all winter long right after getting shot and not having any food. It's probably not going to survive the winter.
Right.
So that's why we recommend it with Creeping Charlie. And the data that have been done from studies show that we get better overall control of Creeping Charlie and some of these hard-to-control weeds at that time of the year. The best compound is one that's sold known as triclopyr. And so when you go to a store, and I empathize with everybody out there, when you go to a store and you try to find an herbicide, they're pretty much all going to have the same active ingredients, just at different ratios. But you want to try to find one that has triclopyr in it, and it's hard to find. And if you can find one that has triclopyr in it, especially in, it will say, either an amine form or a salt form or an ester form. If you can find one that says triclopyr in an ester form, that's going to give you your best possible control. Otherwise, you use whatever you can get, a broadleaf herbicide, and it won't be as great, but it'll be pretty good. So we're talking a difference of 70% control with a conventional broadleaf weed versus close to 100% control with the triclopyr ester.
And we'll be back with our guest, John Steyer. Stay with us. We're talking lawn and turf care on this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here, and my guest today, John Steyer, UW Extension Lawn and Turf Research Expert in the Department of Horticulture at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, comes by every so often to talk with us about lawn and turf care. And I know we've got issues relating to winterizer. We've got dog problems that have been linked to a fungus in a yard. Wondering about that a little bit. Somebody is more on short-tailed shrews. Some information or questions about soil testing. And I'm sure there are going to be a whole lot more. And you can join in the fun here. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. If you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. And then you can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And we'll be right back after this look at the news. We are talking lawn and turf care today with John Steyer, UW Extension horticulturist. Larry Mueller here. He's a lawn and turf research expert at the UW-Madison. I'm glad to have him back. Give us a call if you have a question at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Let's go to Catherine in Wausau next. Hi, Catherine.
Good morning. I mean, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And I have a question about the yard. We have a lot of pine trees, sandy soil. Did water this past summer, spring, but not an over amount. And I have two questions. One about what type of winterizer to put on the lawn. And the second question is, we have where there's a lot of pine trees, the lawn is, we have like tufty grass, and then there's like sparse areas where there's not much grass at all, but there's kind of like tufts of grass. Is there anything I can do about that?
Well, let's start with the winterizer fertilizer. The term winterizer fertilizer has been abused so much by people that sell fertilizer, I'm no longer sure what it means. It's supposed to be something that's high in potassium, because there's some anecdotal evidence, although no good research proof, that potassium applied before a stress period like winter improves the overall health of the turf. I don't buy that from a scientific standpoint, because all the research that's been done can't back that up. But I've also seen retailers trying to sell product high in phosphorus, which in the spring they sold as a starter fertilizer. Now they're trying to sell as a winterizer fertilizer just to get rid of it. So I don't put much stock in winterizer terminology. What you do want is something that has some water-soluble nitrogen to feed the roots. Now, you got sandy soils, and it's shaded. So on the bag, it's going to have directions for applying the full rate or applying a half rate. In your situation, you want to apply the half rate because you don't want the nitrogen to leach through the sand, and because the turf is already growing in the shade, it doesn't need as much nitrogen.
Okay.
So...
And now in terms of a nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, well, in some places you can't use phosphorus.
Yeah, it depends. Now, what you would probably want to do ideally is have a soil test result telling you if there's a phosphorus and or potassium deficiency in the soil. If it's a sandy soil, there's a good chance that it is going to be deficient in phosphorus or potassium. So a soil test can be run through, there's a number of soil testing labs. You look in the Yellow Pages, and you'll find one in your area. The UW also has a lab down at Madison and another one up at Marshfield as well. And they'll test the soil. A soil test should cost about $15, $20. You get it done every 3 to 5 years.
And what are you guessing that the numbers might be? What do you think that I'm looking at for a winterizer fertilizer, like 24, 3, 12, or what?
Yeah, it really could. Like I said, the people selling the fertilizers in the stores these days, the numbers really have no relevancy in my mind anymore for what they're selling as winterizer fertilizer. Generally speaking, turf fertilizer should have a big number for nitrogen, like a 24, a 20 or 24 or something like that. And usually a small number or a zero for phosphorus, depending on if phosphorus is needed or not. In an intermediate number, maybe a 6 or 10 or something like that for potassium.
I see.
Okay.
Phosphorus will usually be 0 to 3.
Okay.
All right.
And what about my...
About your grass and tufts of grass. So it sounds like it's a shaded situation, and the grass, it's the tufts of grass there are growing probably where it gets a fleck of sunlight.
Oh.
And it's not growing in the areas it's not getting sunlight.
Oh, sure. A little hole in the...
Little hole in the window of the tree canopy. So your option is you can try to plant fine fescues, and they may or may not grow depending on how much shade there actually is. But they do fairly well in dry soils as well as shade.
I see.
All right.
Okay, thanks a lot. Have a good day.
Yeah, you too. Thank you. Thanks a lot for calling, Catherine. Tom in Green Bay, hello.
Hi. I'd like to readdress your short-tailed shrew comments.
Sure.
They aren't going to girdle your trees. They don't do that. They're omnivorous. Basically, at this time of year, they're feeding on grubs, insects. They feed on carrion. They eat mice. They eat your meadow voles. They eat your deer mice. It's one of the few critters we have in the state of Wisconsin that's actually poisonous. They have a neurotoxin in their saliva, and they can overcome a much larger meadow vole than themselves. Most shrews, short tails, you're talking about an animal that basically almost has to eat its body weight every day. So right now, you know, they're probably a positive. Very often you will see them if you have outside bird feeders in the wintertime. You will see very often they will come in and they will be feeding on insects and actually some of the seeds and things that fall on the ground. But for the most part, they're not going to do much to your lawn or your vegetation.
Have you ever seen them burrow into the lawn?
Well, they're chasing mice, and they don't really burrow.
But they'll use another animal's horn.
Yeah. They're chasing things.
Yeah.
And they're cyclic, you know, depending on conditions and, you know, how things go. But basically, as far as lawns and things, they're not that, you know. You will see them going down, you know, in the wintertime, you have microtis. You have little tunnels through your grass underneath the snow. If you have an infestation of microtis, meadow voles, and the shrews will run right down those things and chase them and catch them and eat them.
Well, that's good. That's good to know. It's a biocontrol then.
Yes.
For the voles. Excellent.
Yep. And they love to eat grubs.
So somebody who has a lot of shrews may be in a situation
He's
where they have...
He's probably got an infestation.
Of something or other. Yeah. And I misspoke, and I said I was thinking voles when I said... When I said shrews.
Yeah, they're the ones that do all the damage.
They're the ones. You're absolutely right.
Yep.
Thanks a lot for straightening that out, Tom.
Okay.
Yeah, appreciate the call. That's good. It's good to have somebody straighten me out here a little bit because it really is voles that I should have been talking about instead of shrews. But I'll tell you what, Scott might have some input on that, too. Scott Craven, next week, Wednesday. We'll hear what he's got to say. Brian in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Brian.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. I got a quick question for you. Every time this year, and we hit autumn, my dog gets spots on his fur that he loses, and the vet said it is probably from a fungus in the yard. Is there anything I can do to get rid of the fungus?
He gets spots on his body?
Yeah, where he loses his fur.
I've never heard of anything like that.
No.
Your vet says that?
Yeah, she says probably just something in the yard this time of year, and it causes it.
I have never heard of that. A fungus from the yard that can cause a dog's hair to fall out?
Yep.
And interesting.
It's basically around his paws and then the top of his head.
Boy.
That is interesting. It would seem to me that a vet who specialized in mycological or fungal diseases of dogs would be able to take a look at the spores and tell us what type of fungus that is.
Okay.
Hmm. Yeah, probably.
Okay. Because
I've
a
never
fungus
heard that,
that grows on plants, we've never seen a fungus growing on plants attacking dogs that I've ever heard of. But, you know, nature is wild and wacky and wonderful.
Okay. All right, well, I'll call back when Calling All Pets is on and see if they have an answer.
Patricia might have a chance that I may have an answer for that. And I'm also looking at the same time online here to see what I can come up with. Jeff in Oshkosh, your turn. Hi, Jeff.
I've got these tiny little hills sprouting up all over my lawn. I live in the city, got a typical grass lawn, and last year I laid down a bunch of dirt to even it out because it was kind of wavy. And so I know these tiny little hills, they're like the size of a half a ping pong ball, and there's hundreds of them, and they're really aggravating because it's quite uncomfortable to walk on when I go out in my bare feet. So I'm wondering if you can tell me, are these ants or they're some kind of...
Is the soil kind of a clay soil that seems to be coming up?
Oh, no, not on top. It's good black dirt.
Okay. These little hills, are they textured? Like ribbons almost on top of ribbons or anything like that? Or is it just loose soil?
Well, when I break them up, it's not so much soil.
So it's something that you have to break up. And what does it seem to be?
Well, you know, I think it's a long shot, but I'm kind of one of my theories is that it's a bunch of walnuts that the squirrels are bringing and dropping all over the place, and then they sit there for a while and start to break down. But there's just so many of them, I can't see how that would be it.
Well, you know, it depends. I certainly have a lot of squirrels where I live because I kind of live in the woods, and I find their piles of nuts all over the place. The other thing, if it's truly a soil, I would suspect earthworms. But if it's not soil, then my guess is it would be some sort of animal bringing something in.
Yeah, we've got lots of earthworms. So when they, how would an earthworm cause that?
Well, earthworms come up to the surface and they deposit the soil.
Huh.
And it's only certain species.
Sounds interesting.
It does.
Thanks much.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Tom and Shano, your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. I was going to inquire about any suggestions for controlling ants. Where I live, it's very sandy soil, and these ants periodically come up through the black dirt, and then wherever they start, they kind of bring the sand up from the bottom.
Yep. Well, if you want to control the ants, the thing you have to do is kill the queen. And the only way to kill the queen is to get the workers, and that's the ants that you see, to take some bait back to the queen. Because the queen is fat. She doesn't move. She sits down underneath the ground, pumping out eggs day after day. That's her life. And she eats whatever the workers bring her. The difficulty here, though, and there's various ant baits that you can buy and put out. The difficulty here, though, is that there's ants all over the place. And so if you control one colony, it's very likely that another group of ants that have filled up their colony will send out some workers to look for some new place to live, and half that colony is going to go there with a new queen, and they're just going to reinfest the area. Ants come and go. They'll move around. You control one colony this month, there will be another colony someplace else another month. And unfortunately, I think it's just part of nature that we have to live with.
Okay. Thanks a lot for calling. And MJ in Green Lake, hi.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I have an arch enemy called Crown Vetch.
Oh, Crown Vetch.
And someone has planted it, and it's on the property behind me, yep. And the people there have given me permission to do whatever, and I have tried whatever, including I have dug it up and sifted the ground to get all of the roots out, but this stuff is bad news.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering what, without killing everything in the world, can I use to, I mean, it's invading everything.
Yeah.
It'll cover my house soon.
So Crown Vetch was widely used along the highway system roadsides for decades to prevent erosion because it's a fast-growing ground cover, as you know.
Yes.
It has gotten out of hand in a lot of situations to the point where now people are treating it as a weed. I have not seen it occur in a lawn yet, but this kind of sends up a red flag for me that maybe I need to be more alert on this. I currently don't know of any turf herbicides labeled for Crown Vetch because, like I said, I'm not aware of it being a problem in the lawn, but certainly I would think that a conventional broadleaf herbicide for the lawn would be the way to go at this point. And we don't have much of a selection anyways. I know there's dozens of products on the market, but they all have the same active ingredients, more or less.
The stuff I have put on it, I have tried to put just very specifically right where it is along
yep,
the fence line.
And that's the way to do it.
And I have used stuff that's supposed to kill everything, and I think it liked it.
Oh, so you use probably a Roundup or a glyphosate type formulation
right.
Then, okay. I would try just a broadleaf herbicide. You know, there's some weeds. Dandelions are a good example. They're sometimes very tough to kill with glyphosate or glyphosate-like products, which are supposed to kill all types of green vegetation.
Mm-hmm.
So try just a broadleaf herbicide.
Okay. Well, let me tell you, this stuff is definitely taking over lawns. It is along the roadside. I never had it before. It has now jumped probably about 8 feet away and is around a telephone pole.
Yeah.
So if you're looking for a red flag, I have it.
Thank you for the alert, and I'll start looking into that. Thank you.
Okay, thanks much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Nick in Chicago, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Nick.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I want to find out, in Wisconsin, is diazion been removed as it has in Illinois?
Diazinon has been removed for use across the country.
Oh, it has across the country. I was
yes.
Hoping that it was still available in Wisconsin because that has been, you know, diazion was a great insecticide for vegetables and
yep.
for grub control and everything. And since it's been removed, nothing else has really worked as well as diazion has.
That's right. There were concerns that it might, that if people kept using it, it might start to get into our water supplies. So they removed it.
Yeah.
Darn.
Okay. And
I wanted to find out because it was a great grub control, you know, as a granular, and also for insect control for the vegetables. And that's really the only thing that's really worked for, you know, 7 doesn't work as well. Nothing has really worked as well as what diazion used to work.
That's right. And so what was happening was the EPA went back to the manufacturer and said, we're reviewing this product, and if we want to keep it allowed for use, we need this information, this information, this information. The company looked at what it was going to cost to get the EPA that information, and they said, No, thanks. We'll just let it go. We're not going to make money enough money selling it.
What is as close as diazion now?
Oh, people have turned to a wide variety of things. Diazinon was kind of a general insecticide, and what we're turning towards now are insecticides that are much more specific. So you really need to base the type of insecticide that you're going to use on the type of pest that you have that you want to control.
Okay.
Which makes for an interesting situation, because we want to say that we reduce pesticide use, but now that we've got very specific pesticides, if we've got two or three insect pests, we need to apply two or three different things now instead of one. Interesting conundrum.
And now, you know, and anytime you say, okay, what's going to replace seven? Seven is the worst product. It doesn't do anything like diazion used
Seven's
to do.
Seven's an old product. And, yeah, you know, there's been some non-control issues with it. And there are some newer ones that are coming out. And some of the newer products that are coming out are much more environmentally friendly than anything we've ever had before. So stay tuned for further updates.
Thanks, Nick. Thanks a lot for calling. Good luck to you. Joan in La Crosse, it's your turn. Hi, Joan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have an ant solution.
All right.
There's something called diatomaceous earth. With diatoms are a little bitty shell sea creature, something like that. To me, it feels like talc, but to the ants and bugs, it's like little razor blades.
Yep.
And it carries that into the nest, and it cuts everybody all up. I just think we're chasing around, you know, trying to kill a fly with a hammer with a lot of these insecticides.
Well, you know, and this is a good learning point here. When we use diatomaceous earth in that regards, it is classified as a pesticide.
Mm-hmm.
Because a pesticide is any substance that's used to control, kill, or repel a pest. That's the definition of a pesticide, and that's the way the EPA looks at these products.
Hmm.
But you're right. But it won't hurt me if it gets into the groundwater, like pretty much everything else.
Well, and it really shouldn't, because we're going to be using such tiny quantities, and because it's going to get held up by the soil and everything. You're exactly right. From an environmental standpoint, it is probably as totally benign as we can get.
I have a lot of pets, and I feel good about using it in my house and in the yard.
Thanks for calling, Joan. Appreciate it. And one caller said ringworm can attach to wood and then to the dogs.
Ah, okay.
So there's a possible issue in
possible
terms of
issue. Yeah, it's not a fungus, but it's a microscopic worm then. So.
Dan and Stevens Point, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. Hey, I have a question. My neighbor, I use a lot of that spray fertilizer for my lawn.
Okay.
And my neighbor
foliar feeding?
Yeah. I like it. You got to apply it a little bit more often, but
yep.
It doesn't
You're
burn your lawn.
You're spoon feeding the turf.
Sure. And my neighbor mixes his own, and he uses this, he swears by it. He mixes his concoction with a beer, some dish soap, and ammonia, and he claims it works just as well, like a teaspoon of ammonia or a tablespoon.
Yep.
And then he puts it in the old little sprayer, the same one I use, and he says, I'm doing it for about a quarter of the cost of what you're spending. And I was just wondering if there's anything to that.
Yeah. Well, you know, maybe. You know, all those things are going to contain at least nitrogen. Ammonium is nitrogen and hydrogen ions. And then the beer is going to have a mishmash of stuff in it, including nitrogen, phosphorus, and probably some potassium. The ammonia is very interesting, because if you've ever cleaned windows with Windex, what is that? It's ammonia.
Mm-hmm.
It would not be labeled as a fertilizer because it's too toxic to humans. So it's interesting. We can use it on our windows, but it will never be labeled as a fertilizer per se for use by homeowners. Farmers will use anhydrous ammonia, and they take very special precautions not to get lots of ammonia in the air, because it's toxic. And the other thing is, I wonder how much of the ammonia, of the nitrogen from ammonia, is actually getting into the plant, because you can smell ammonia, and that means it's volatilizing, going up in the air and take the nitrogen up with it. So I'd be very curious how much is actually getting into the plant from the ammonia.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And there are lots of interesting questions. And, John, you've answered quite a few of them today.
Oh, it's gone fast, Larry.
Gone fast. Thank you so much.
Good listeners today.
Thank you so much for being with us. John Steyer is an associate professor in the College of Agricultural and Life Sciences at the UW-Madison. And he's an extension lawn and turf research expert in the Department of Horticulture. Pleased to have him along to be with us today. We'll have him back. We'll do it again. Coming up Monday after 11, we'll talk computers and software and accessories with Peter Green of InfoStar of Madison, our personal computer consultant. So we'll look forward to that as well coming Monday. In the meantime, thanks a lot for listening. And of course, we want you to stay around because there's lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.